had articles in many languages, and since 1991, he has been working for the Institute of Historical Review in Southern California. And since 1995, he's been its director. So please put your hands together and give a thunderous welcome to all the way from America, Mark Babo.
Thank you very much, Joe Turner, for your very kind introduction. It's an enormous pleasure to be here today to speak to you. I feel, in a way, very much at home because I feel an enormous kinship, not only with the people I've met so far at this meeting today, but also with the spirit of what is happening here. And I feel a special kinship with Jez Turner because what he's doing is, in many ways, parallels our own work in Southern California. When we were talking last night, I put a tremendous emphasis on the importance of people actually meeting in person. It's a very, very important thing psychologically and for building up something beyond just ourselves, for going beyond our own sense of being all alone on our ideas and so forth. And so what I feel very, very fortunate in that way. Now, Jez Turner and I have been in touch by email for maybe a year or 2 years. And he'd been sending me notices about the meetings and so forth. I was very glad to see that. And he basically said some time ago, if I'm ever in England or next time I'm in England, he'd be happy to try to arrange that I would be able to speak. And so I'm very happy to be able to take up that invitation. But in that regard, I'm very grateful also to Gregory Johnson, where is he right now? Okay. Because he's the one actually invited for this particular occasion for me to appear. And of course, this is all tied up. I'm in Europe also to attend the conference in Budapest that will be taking place, the European conference that is happening there. And I'm also very happy that I'm going to be speaking today along with Adrian Davis, who is not here yet, unfortunately. But Adrian Davis and I go back quite a way. He has spoken at a number of our meetings in Southern California, and he brings to our meetings a very, very unique and specialized knowledge about the situation, the political scene in Britain, but also on the continent, because he's lived there for some time too. So between Greg Johnson and Jez Turner, and also other people too, I feel, even though I'm far away from home, I feel in a way very much at home, not just intellectually and spiritually and so forth, but also because of the human ties that bring me here. In fact, this is perhaps my third or fourth time that I'm in England. And the very first time I was in England, I was pretty young. In fact, it was nearly 40 years ago. And one of the most interesting things was last night I met a man who we had met actually in person, 38 years ago it was, I guess. And here we are, and time has taken its toll, of course, but I'm very happy to renew this friendship. And on that occasion, during that meeting, I was young, I was very open-eyed, very, very like a sponge taking up things and so forth, but it was on that occasion that I was very pleased to meet and have lunch with and get to know John Tyndall, who actually I later met in the United States. I met Martin Webster on that occasion. I met also and had lunch with Richard Verrill. And also I got to know Tony Hancock very well, who of course had Historical Review Press and his father. And I was a guest of his for a week or several days in Brighton. And those were very, very heady, very exciting times for me. And I've been back to England several times since then. Of course, I've been back on the continent of Europe many times since then. But I'm very happy to be here on this occasion, especially because it's been quite a while since my last visit to England. The topic I'm going to be talking about tonight is our situation, the dilemma, the crisis for our people. And by our people, I mean people of European culture, European ancestry, European origin, who feel this kind of kinship that binds us all together. And with special reference, of course, to how the situation is changing. I compare it a little bit like before there is an earthquake, there is under the ground the shifting of powerful forces under the earth. the shifting of tectonic plates, the shifting of these forces. Before a volcano explodes, there is a buildup of powerful forces below the surface. I think we're seeing a similar time in our world today, a similar building up of forces, a similar shifting of power. And above all, the shifting is the end of what I call the post-war era, the era from 1945 up until about the 1980s, when the United States and the Soviet Union were the dominant powers, but especially in Western Europe, the United States and the world had this dominant position, and we're seeing that changing today. We're seeing the end of this kind of American domination of the world, not so much politically or financially or power or militarily. The United States is still, of course, the number one military power in the world by far. The American military budget is about 40% of the entire world's military budget. The United States is still the number one financial power, of course. The US dollar is still the number one reserve currency in the world, and still, with China closing the gap, is still the number one economy in the world. But having said that, something has very drastically changed. And one of the most important changes is that any country that presumes to be a leader in the world, that plays itself out to be a model for the world, has to also be a country that is a society that is a model for the world. And that is no longer the case. Nowhere in the world does anyone say, I want our cities to look like Los Angeles or Detroit or to be like Chicago. No one in the world says, I want our society to be modeled after the United States. For all the oppression, perhaps, or however the downside there might be of the British Empire, 100 years ago, when people came from the far reaches of the British Empire to London, they were in awe. They were in awe of a society as confident, as much of a model society as Britain was in those days. And whether they were from India or from South Africa, if they had any ambitions for their sons, they said and felt that they wanted their sons to be like Englishmen. People around the world do not say, I want our sons to be like Bill Clinton or Barack Obama. Nobody talks like that. Now, one of the signs of the change that's taking place is the recent upsurge of anti-establishment, or certainly non-establishment, political parties in Europe. And of course, no one's more familiar with that than the people here in this room. And this was especially manifest in the May European Union parliamentary elections, which saw an astonishing, at least for many people, a very surprising rise of anti-establishment, or certainly non-establishment political parties. Of course, the remarkable showing of UKIP here in Britain, the remarkable first place showing of the National Front in France, in Denmark, the Danish People's Party, topped the poll, doubled its numbers of members of the European Parliament. And, of course, we all are familiar with, in Hungary, the Jobbik Party is now the third largest political party in that country. Just recently, of course, in Sweden, Sweden Democrats, again, a party not part of the usual duopoly of the conservative moderate, whatever you call it in different countries, whatever their name might be, or the moderate leftist party, whether you call it the Labour Party, Social Democratic Party, in other countries. Of course, there was an immense commentary about all of this, and one of the commentaries was that from the New York Times, and the columnist wrote, "The European Union is still reeling from the insurgency of this past week's elections to the 751-member parliament, but after a political earthquake, as the French Prime Minister Manuel Valls called it on Sunday, it is also worth sifting through the rubble of hyperbole in search of resilient continuities." And again, he emphasizes the European Union election, parliamentary elections, as an expression of this kind of anti-establishment sentiment that you find across the continent. One of the most interesting commentaries on the May election results was provided by the leading English language newspaper of Israel, the Jerusalem Post, in an editorial. The Zionist Daily observed, and I quote, "The results are worrying for those who hoped that in the wake of World War II, Europeans were gradually moving away from nationalist, ethnocentric political identities toward a more liberal, universalistic political arrangement. Inevitably, Europe's Jews are likely to be worse off as a result. After this week's elections, the inevitability of European integration is looking implausible, and this is bad for the Jews. Well, I don't want to, this talk is not really about Zionism or Israel, I'm talking really about the European situation. I don't want to put too fine a point on it here and now, but such words from Israel are another good example of the eye-popping hypocrisy and proverbial chutzpah that we've seen from this country. An influential Zionist newspaper that for more than half a century has been a staunch defender of Israel's identity and character as a distinctly Jewish ethno-religious society is complaining when people in other countries make even limited efforts to defend their own ethnic, cultural identity and character. Now, above all, the recent election results also highlighted, I think, the intellectual bankruptcy of the establishment parties in Europe. The thinkers, writers, and ideologues of the establishment political parties that have governed Europe since the end of the Second World War, whether they regard themselves as conservative or moderate or middle class, or whether they regard themselves as leftist, progressive, have totally run out of convincing ideas and lack any credible vision for the future. This is absolutely... noted, for example, that by the New York Times writer Roger Cohen, who remarked unhappily on what he calls the ideological void in France in the wake of the May elections. And he wrote, and here's what he wrote, the French are unhappy has become a commonplace. A nation that loves ideas is living in an ideological void. If that void is filled by anyone, it is the rightist leader, Marine Le Pen, and her cleverly dosed venom, his words, about Europe, immigrants, crime, globalization, and other supposed culprits behind French national decline. Unemployment in France is about double the German level, growth is at zero, investment is at new lows. And of course, even since then, the standing, I won't say popularity, but the standing of President Hollande has fallen to all-time lows. And nothing better illustrates the bankruptcy of the system, because he's a supposed socialist who, like the labor or socialist or social democratic leaders across Europe, have most pointedly betrayed their own base of support, the working people of their own country. So bleak has the social economic outlook become in Europe that a few months ago, Pope Francis was moved to make a scathing attack on the system that prevails in the U.S. and Europe, warning that it is near collapse because of what he called, and I'm quoting, a throwaway culture of greed, and what he calls the atrocity of youth unemployment. The Roman Catholic leader openly bashed what he calls the idolatrous economy for disregarding the young, which he has said has led to shocking levels of youth unemployment and will lead to a lost generation. That's the Pope severely, hardly in words that can hardly be overdone, the system that we live in Europe and of course in the United States as well. Now all this, including these European Union election results in May, are obviously an expression of much more than just anxiety about the lackluster economic situation. They express a widespread lack of confidence in the establishment political parties and growing unhappiness with the general direction of social, cultural, and economic life across Europe. Across Europe, as well as in the United States, people sense that something is very wrong. Large-scale immigration, especially from Africa, the Middle East, South Asia, is fueling and accelerating, we can see it everywhere, third worldization, dramatically transforming the cultural, racial, and ethnic character of this venerable continent. Across Europe, the birth rate, as you well know, is below replacement level. Europeans are dying out. Mainstream politicians, again in the United States as well as in Europe, are utterly unable to offer any convincing way out of this malaise or any credible prospect for a better future. What we see are politicians simply mouthing slogans that they hardly even believe themselves, and the public they're speaking to knows that they don't really believe them themselves. Public opinion surveys, as you may know, on both sides of the Atlantic, show high and unprecedented levels of distrust in politicians, major institutions, in short, of the entire establishment. Europe and the United States are ever more obviously in the grip of a social, political, and cultural decline. And in this regard, of course, America, the leader, is setting the pace, as it were. With each passing year, the United States is ever more obviously and rapidly becoming an unrecognizable third world country. During my lifetime, many cities and a good number of states in the United States have been transformed demographically, with the replacement of an overwhelmingly European origin population with a non-white one. Over the past half century, Southern California, where I live and work, has been transformed, and this is important, has been transformed more radically, more fundamentally, than Poland, Hungary, and other Eastern European countries changed during nearly 50 years of Soviet Russian occupation and domination. We are changing ourselves more radically than the Soviet Union was able to change the countries that it brought under its control. The confident, proud, and comfortable America of the 1950s and 60s is gone, and it is gone forever. Now, I'm going to spend a little time talking about a book that I think is the most amazing, insightful analysis of what is happening in Europe and really in the entire West. And it's this book. You may have heard of it. Thilo Sorensen, German. The book is called Deutschland schafft sich ab. It means Germany does away with itself. This book has generated tremendous discussion in Germany. Now, it's generated also some discussion in the media outside, but the focus is really on Germany. But the big thing is that this book's analysis applies, of course, with some variations, to the entire Western world. Now, it's not merely the content of this book that's remarkable. It's also important because the author of this book is someone whom very few would expect to write such a work. A man with impressive credentials to present such a probing and challenging analysis of the trends of recent decades. The author, again, Thilo Sorensen, he served on the directorate of the German Federal Railway, and more importantly, was a member of the governing board of the Bundesbank, Germany's central bank. For 7 years, he was what they call the Finanzsenator of Berlin, that is, the financial affairs minister of the government of Germany's capital city, and for many years was a member, not of some extreme organization, but of the SPD, the country's leftist establishment Social Democratic Party. Sorensen's book is carefully written, it's diligently researched, and compellingly argued. The author persuasively, I think compellingly, presents his case with reason and rigorous logic, supported by solid data and empirical evidence. After it was published in 2010, 4 years ago, it became an instant sensation. Immediately, establishment newspapers and prominent public figures in Germany lost no time in furiously denouncing this book and its author. But the attacks and the smears against the author had the effect of enormously stimulating sales of the book. Everyone in Germany, it seems, was talking about this book, and more importantly, the very serious issues that he addresses. Probably no German book since the end of the Second World War has had such an impact on the cultural, intellectual life of the nation. And eventually, no less than 1.5 million copies of this book were sold. In the introduction, the author stresses that the problems of Germany, and again, by extension, of Europe and of the entire Western world, are deep-rooted. These are not easily solvable problems. They are deep-rooted ones. The sluggish economy is only a symptom of much more serious and entrenched social, cultural, demographic, and genetic biological problems. In addition to the socially suicidal birth rate, which is below replacement level, of course, Germany's future is endangered because of the steady, continuing increase in the portion of the population that is less socially stable, less intelligent, and less capable. Again, to even mention these subjects is to really touch on a very difficult thing, but the author does so in a very forthright way. He points out that economically, Germany is now in the final phase of a golden era, one that began about 1950 or so, rebuilding from World War II, and which is now coming to an end. He points out that income in real terms for individual workers has not increased over the past 20 years. And moreover, he says, and he gives very solid evidence for this, within 10 years at the most, it'll begin declining and it will just not stop. This has already been basically the case in the United States. Real wages in the United States have stayed stagnant for 20 years, real income has, real wealth has gone down in the United States as well. And of course, we're all familiar with the enormous discussion that's been generated in the last few years about the growing gap in inequality between the very rich and the very poor throughout the United States and indeed in the Western world. Because of the this stagnation and decline is due above all to long-term demographic factors, this trend is inevitable and unstoppable. However, we see news, of course, for Germans anyway, news of successes and achievements from time to time about exports, research, and so forth. He makes the point that all of these kinds of things that look good are short-term blips, you might say, on the radar screen, and they will not be able to reverse the basic trend. Germany, and again, I have to stress the rest of Europe, by extension, the Western world, has been destroying the very foundation of future economic growth, both quantitatively and qualitatively. Quantitatively, because, as he explains, for the past 45 years, each new generation is one-third smaller than the previous one, while at the same time, life expectancy has been rising. That's already a very, very difficult problem, conundrum to try to deal with. And qualitatively, because with each new generation, the genetic and social cultural foundation of the nation is steadily falling. Germany, he goes on, is a society in denial about basic realities of social political life. And once again, what Sarrazin writes here applies, with some variations, of course, to the entire Western world, to Britain and the United States. He also makes the point, too, about a phenomenon that we're all familiar with and one of the reasons why we're meeting under these circumstances. In spite of my years of experience in public life, I've been astonished at the negative response that's generated when a public figure points out simply and clearly the most elementary facts of social political life. Another important factor behind the long-term trend he discusses is the way that Germans are socialized or socially motivated. In the nation's schools and mass media, Germans are encouraged to lead a self-oriented life, or if they prefer, a life that has no focus whatsoever. In Germany today, and again in Europe, throughout Europe, in the United States, in the Western world, it's taken for granted now that individual concerns and identity are paramount. Not what's good for the nation, not what's good for the community, but the individual happiness is considered to be paramount. And of course, this comes above all from the influence of the United States of America, where this is a kind of a doctrine and ideology of the United States. As a result of this, there is a dull, widespread sense of fatalism about prospects for the future. Germans accept, or are supposed to accept, as inexorable, as inevitable, that Germany will decline in population, as well as in average intelligence and skill. He emphasizes the close and empirically irrefutable relationship between the level of prosperity and orderliness in a society and the average intelligence level of its people. And he also notes the fact that many of those in educational and political life deny or ignore that human intelligence is 50 to 80% determined by heredity. Yeah. He provides solid data to show that in the West, the genetic intelligence level has been falling in recent decades because, in general, the least intelligent are having more children than the more intelligent. He also points out that the average intelligence level of immigrants who are moving into Germany is significantly lower than the average German level. In short, he writes, the social system that prevails in his homeland means that Germany is doing away with itself. Again, this is a problem not confined here. I only mention it because this book lays this out. One of the most remarkable things about this book is that he cites here the work of some of the most remarkable, controversial writers in the United States. He cites, for example, the book The Bell Curve, which came out, what, some 20 years ago by Murray and Herrnstein, which I think irrefutably shows the relationship between intelligence in a society and how it's distributed, shows the relation to intelligence society, how it's distributed, and also, of course, touches on and documents the different intelligence level of different groups of society. But he also cites, and this was a really surprising thing, the work of Kevin MacDonald, who many of you might be familiar with. To cite the work of Kevin MacDonald in a mainstream book is already a remarkable thing, but he does that in this book. Now, ladies and gentlemen, the outcome of the Second World War was a fateful one for the world, because it meant, for the first time in history, that Europe was entirely under the control of outer European states, or at least states that are on the periphery of the West, namely the United States of America and the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. More important, the outcome of the Second World War meant the imposition on Europe of an egalitarian ideology, a Soviet Marxist version in Eastern and Central Europe, and in Western Europe, a more seductive and all the more insidious American version. Since the collapse of the Soviet Union in the late 1980s, the American egalitarian individualist ideology, as well as US-style mass democracy, now prevail across Europe. That's considered the norm everywhere, and people had better not deviate from it. From the beginning, and this is important, ideas have consequences. If people didn't believe that, none of us would be here. And that's why these kinds of meetings are very important. From the very beginning, the American ideology was considered in the United States so magnificent, so transformational, that the founders regarded the USA as a radically new kind of society, a nation that would be and should be a model for the world. That's why the Great Seal of the United States, which is on the back of every $1 bill, proclaims that 1776 is not merely the year of the country's birth, but marks the founding of what it calls in Latin a novus ordo seclorum, a new order of the ages. In keeping with this view of American society and its form of government as superior to all others, politicians of both major parties in the United States proclaim with almost religious fervor their belief in something called American exceptionalism. And you'll hear this not only from those who call themselves conservative or patriotic. In a recent address at West Point Military Academy, President Obama said, and I'm quoting, "I believe in American exceptionalism with every fiber of my being." Again, it's kind of the phrase that I don't know if he even really believes it himself. Nobody really believes he believes it. But this is the way politicians talk, every fiber of his being. Well, okay. This ideology not only means that the United States is the morally superior leader and the grand architect in forging a new order in the world, but implies that there is a purposeful trajectory to history, a definite direction in human development, and that Americans are the providentially ordained pioneers in shaping the entire world in accord with this ideology. Over the past century, American presidents have repeatedly affirmed this confident, but also arrogant and utopian view about the direction of history and America's role in it. You may know almost 100 years ago, President Woodrow Wilson solemnly proclaimed that the United States was entering the First World War and sending young Americans across the ocean to kill and die in a grand undertaking to end all war, to make the world safe for democracy. Later, President Franklin Roosevelt made similar pledges during World War II, likewise in keeping with the supposed purposeful view of history and the country's central ideology. The United States, Franklin Roosevelt proclaimed, is the great world leader in shaping a new global order in which aggression will be eliminated permanently. And beyond that, he said, in which even fear and want will be banished in the world. In this same outlook moved President George Bush to refer to a so-called war on terrorism as a crusade, and in one major speech to proclaim a U.S. foreign policy dedicated to, as he put it, ending tyranny in the world. Faithful to America's ideology, President Obama proclaims that an important feature of U.S. foreign policy is to push for what he calls gay rights everywhere in the world. Now, because the United States is still a very powerful and influential country, it has the ability to promote and impose, sometimes with astonishing arrogance, its egalitarian, individualist ideology in Europe and indeed around the world. Prominent Americans take pride in the notion that the U.S. is or should be the great leader in making an ever more diverse, non-racial, and multicultural world. This has been voiced, for example, by U.S. General Wesley Clark, Supreme Allied Commander in Europe with overall command of NATO military forces on the continent. In June of 1999, General Clark said, and I'm quoting, "In the modern Europe, there is no room for homogeneous national states. It was an idea from the 1800s, and we are going to carry it, that is, multiculturalism, through, and we are going to create multicultural states." I can hardly imagine a statement more saturated with arrogance than this kind of statement that made by a major American general. But it reflects, in general, this remark by General Clark, along with other American leaders, what they mean by this is that France must not be French, Scotland must not be Scottish, and England must not be English. In keeping with this ideology, the United States works to break down cultural, racial, and religious identity and cohesion everywhere in the world, prodding, cajoling, persuading, not only the government, but the mass media and Hollywood, and pushing every country to be like the United States, a collection of individuals, a cultural and racial melting pot. Thus, the Americanization of Europe means the cultural, biological death of Europe. In spite of its relative economic prosperity, Europe today is in greater danger than ever before in its history, far worse than the consequences of military defeat, or of a terrible war, or of a devastating plague. Europe is threatened with cultural, ethnic, and racial extinction. That is, the destruction of the very foundation of everything that is European in any real or lasting sense. Today, a venerable heritage of thousands of years is threatened with extinction. What is Europe? It is, of course, a geographic designation, but it is much more than that. Without Europeans, the continent is little more than a geographic or administrative designation, no more meaningful than the term North America. Europe is not only a priceless cultural achievement built over millennia, it is also an equally priceless genetic heritage. The European cultural heritage cannot be separated from the distinct people that created it. There can be no real Europe without Europeans. That's why. And that's why, far beyond the borders of the European continent, Europe, as a social and cultural factor, has also existed wherever European men and women have settled, in Australia, in New Zealand, in Canada, and, to a greater or lesser extent, in the United States of America. Indeed, the central fact of American history is that it was founded, settled, and developed by people of European race and culture. If my homeland had been founded and developed mostly by people from Africa, or East Asia, or by the continent's native population, its social, cultural, and political character today would be very different. If the territory of the USA had been founded and developed by the native peoples of the Western Hemisphere, it would today be a society that resembles Peru, Guatemala, Honduras, or Mexico. If it had been founded and developed mostly by people from Africa, it would today resemble Haiti. Not just Europeans and most Americans, but millions and millions of people around the world want to live in societies built and fashioned by Europeans. But the blunt truth is that it is not possible to have a European-style society without a racially European population. It's not possible to have a society like Denmark with a population like that of Mexico. Of course, as we all know, that's not what we're told. In Europe, as well as in the United States, the leadership of the major political parties, along with the mainstream media and the educational establishment, tell us that race does not matter. It is merely, as they call it, a social construct. Now, as fashionable as this idea is, doctrine is today, it was not always so. Up until World War II, it was still possible to speak openly and candidly, even in a mainstream forum, voicing views that were in accord with the sentiments of most people of European race and culture. One American who not only understood that reality, but who proclaimed it boldly was Charles A. Lindbergh, the famed aviator, author, and peace activist. In an article entitled Aviation, Geography, and Race, written shortly after the outbreak of the war in Europe in 1939, he warned, in words that bear remembering today, against the efforts by some to bring the United States into the conflict. In this article, which appeared 75 years ago in Reader's Digest, the most widely read American magazine of the time, he wrote, and I'm quoting, "We, the heirs of European culture, are on the verge of a disastrous war, a war within our own family of nations, a war which will reduce the strength and destroy the treasures of the white race, a war which may even lead to the end of our civilization. It is time to turn from our quarrels and to build our white ramparts again. Our civilization depends on a united strength among ourselves, standing together as guardians of our common heritage." We can have peace and security only so long as we band together to preserve that most priceless possession, our inheritance of European blood. At about the same time, within weeks of this appearance of this article, Lindbergh spoke to the American public in an address broadcast, imagine this, on nationwide radio. It was on October 13, 1939, in a talk entitled Neutrality War. He said, imagine words like this on the radio today in America. Our bond with Europe, he said, is a bond of race and not a political ideology. It is the European race we must preserve. Political progress will follow. Racial strength is vital, politics a luxury. Now, of course, today the situation is drastically different. Political, cultural, and intellectual leaders on both sides of the Atlantic relentlessly promote an egalitarian, universalist ideology, an outlook of wishful thinking, divorced from reality, that refuses to acknowledge the most elementary truths of society, of heredity, and of history. In accord with this ideology, political leaders in Europe, as well as in the United States, push policies that break down and are meant to break down the traditional cultural, racial, and ethnic character of Western society. The current crisis is therefore an entirely predictable result of the egalitarian individualist ideology that prevails in Europe and the United States, and the underlying premises about life and society on which policies are made. When I reflect, it's now 2014. It's 100 years ago, the most terrible of calamities for the Western civilization, the First World War, began. In 1914, virtually the entire planet was under the control of Europeans or people of European race and culture. Today, Europeans are hardly even in control of their own lands. This is how drastically the situation has changed in one century. 1914, of course, London was the center of an enormous global encircling empire. Today, England can barely defend its own cultural heritage here in this land. Now, this trend is enough to make anyone very, very unhappy about the long-term trends that we see around this. And what people often ask me, well, Mr. Weber, if all this is true, what's the point? It's hopeless. What can we do? Well, I'm going to try to answer that. I find it helpful in my life to remind myself over and over that if I keep my expectations low and concentrate on what I can and should do, I will not be so much disappointed. So I regard, in my view, the outcome of the Second World War as a fatal catastrophe for Europe and the West. During the war, the leaders of Germany and the other Axis countries warned that defeat would be a mortal calamity for all of Europe. In 1943, the great French writer Louis Ferdinand Céline wrote that the Germans and the other Axis forces were the last great bulwark of Europe. Accordingly, he said, the fall of Stalingrad was the end of Europe. Now, of course, I hope that Céline and others who shared that view were wrong, but I'm not overly concerned with that. I try not to think and make some calculation of what the future might be or should be or will be. I believe that the most important thing is each and every one of us ask, what can I do? What should I do? Each of us should strive to do what is right. Each of us should strive to do his duty as we try to see it. Duty, this word, the great American military commander Robert E. Lee once said, is the most sublime word in our language. Today, just as the former Soviet Union eventually fell apart as an inevitable consequence of trying to organize society on the basis of an ideology and principles unrooted in historical, social, and biological reality, so also, I believe this society must and will continue to decline as it tries to force nature and reality to conform to wishful thinking based on an unsound worldview. A nation that embraces an ideology that is not rooted in reality, that is an ideology of denial, of falsehood, of wishful thinking, cannot endure. It will not survive. It does not deserve to survive. And therefore, to devote energy to trying to restore or salvage such a society is a waste of time and effort. What is needed, therefore, is not reform of a terminally ill system, but a new beginning. The era that we are living in today is one that religions of the East call a Kali Yuga, an age of darkness, of perverted values, an age that rewards those who deceive and punishes those who tell the truth. What is needed today are not simplistic slogans or childish wishful thinking about a utopian rainbow future, but candor and honesty. Throughout history, it has never been more than a minority of people who have the heart and the soul to care about the future of their nation and of the world, or the wit to understand the great elemental forces that shape our past and our future. Accordingly, our educational efforts by the IHR in the United States, by London Forum here in Britain, and by people across Europe are directed above all, and I think should be directed above all, toward those few who can and must be leaders in the new age that will emerge from the wreckage of this dark era. We must carry on, I believe, fully realizing that the seeds we are planting will take root only among a few. George Orwell once said that in an age of universal deceit, telling the truth is a revolutionary act. You may recall the tale of the Emperor's New Clothes, in which a small boy in a large and silent crowd is the only one to say out loud what the grown-ups think but are too conditioned or intimidated to say. "Look, the Emperor has no clothes," he said. And with those honest words, he exposes and instantly deflates a pretentious fraud. We must be like that honest young lad in the tale by the great Danish writer Hans Christian Andersen, because the frauds that prevail today in our society, here in the United States and in Europe, are, while no less pretentious, are much, much more dangerous. More than ever, it is important to break the silence and proclaim honestly and truthfully the reality. Diversity is not a strength. Race is not a social construct. Heredity matters. History matters. Our duty, ladies and gentlemen, is to hold fast, to not despair, to persevere in this long twilight struggle before the dawn of a new and better age. Our great task in this age of darkness is to bring light, to help keep burning the flickering flame of truth. Thank you very much.
Some time for some questions. Are there any questions?
Not a very difficult question. What was the year that book was published?
It, 4 years ago, in 2010. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Can you spell the name of the author, please? I can't even see anything. Thank you.
Could you just hold the book up for the camera, please?
Is it in English, that book?
No, this book has not been published in English, and many people have wondered why it's not been published. There's a very good review of it on the website of American Renaissance, translated from German. The book is, though, what really is needed is a British and an American or a Western version of this book, because the data and the focus of this book is really on Germany. As I said, the analysis really applies across the entire Western world, but the focus is really very much on Germany, and the data and the emphasis is on that. But it really, what was really needed is an equivalent book for Britain, for the United States, and for the other countries.
Yes. How does that relate to Pap Gannon's book, Suicide of a Superpower? Is it similar?
No, it's not similar. Pap Gannon's book, Suicide of a Superpower, is good in laying out the problem, but he does not go anywhere near into the depth that this man does. Above all, Suicide of the Web, Suicide of a Superpower, Pap Gannon does not really analyze the demographic, racial, hereditary issues to the point that this man does. This book is far more rigorous, far more deep, you might say. I mean, what Pap Gannon says is good, and he's a very, very worthy writer. Almost everything he says is worthwhile. On the website of the IHR, I very, very routinely post almost everything he has to say, because he's very good in his analysis. But he's not so good in saying what should happen. And I mean, I have my own reasons why Pat Buchanan, I think, is perhaps a slave of his own background. He was a member of the Richard Nixon presidential administration, and later for Ronald Reagan. And he feels very torn, I think, between a kind of devotion to the system and a critique of the system. This book is far more probing than Pat Buchanan's book. Buchanan wrote another book before Suicide of a Superpower called Death of the West, I think. And to me, it was very disappointing in how it concluded. He tries to sum up, well, why is this all happening? How did we get into this mess? How did we come to this? And the final conclusion he comes to is the power or influence of the Frankfurt School. But that's an entirely inadequate explanation. Frankfurt School was a small group of intellectuals. If a small group of intellectuals was able to have tremendous power, we'd all be, what, Scientologists or Joe? I mean, we'd be who knows what. We'd have a theocracy or something. No, I mean, the Frankfurt School only has power because its ideas and are part of something larger that's very much part of the American ideology, and I've gone to that in much more detail. Wesley Clark isn't saying what he's saying, and Barack Obama isn't saying what they're saying because they're puppets or minions of the Frankfurt School. It's a far deeper problem than that. Yes, sir.
To what extent does Ron Paul offer any light on the situation?
Ron Paul is, people often ask, well, who do you admire of American politicians? And usually I say, above all, I admire those men who at least have sincere, consistent beliefs, who are honest. Most American politicians are not honest. They don't even believe what they say themselves. But there are a few exceptions. Ron Paul is one of them. He genuinely, he's an honest man. He's a consistent man. He's held to his views in spite of all sorts of brickbats and criticism. Pat Buchanan is another. Ralph Nader is another. Ralph Nader is an honest man. Now, I disagree with certain things about each of these men, but at least they're honest. At least they are principled men. They are men who are not the usual politicians. But Ron Paul's, and Ron Paul deserves tremendous credit, I think, for his analysis, above all, of America's stupid foreign policy in the Middle East and around the world. He wants an American foreign policy that is based on the traditional view that George Washington, non-interference in foreign affairs and so forth. That's all fine. However, Ron Paul is a representative of a large trend in America of libertarianism. It is something very entrenched in America, this idea of individualism. And to that extent, I think Ron Paul's analysis is essentially a wrong one. He has no regard whatsoever for the importance of heredity. He has no regard really for culture. He regards the ideal society as one as a collection of individuals. A healthy society is more than that. A healthy society has some cohesion, racially, culturally, ethnically, something. And Ron Paul, like many Americans, he takes for granted, as I said, the central fact of American life, that it was founded and developed by Europeans. And he believes instead that American society, insofar as it's been successful and prosperous, is all due to a wonderful constitution or documents or things like that. It's really, I think, pretty silly. But it's understandable because he represents a very strong current in American intellectual life. Yes.
Thank you for that.
Yes, you then.
Thank you. Thank you, Mark, for a fantastic talk. What do you feel about the prospect that we could possibly be beyond a democratic solution to our problems at the moment, and we are on the verge of something possibly a bit more?
Well, as I said, I think the system is doomed. It cannot be reformed. It cannot be salvaged. It's based on premises that are inherently wrong. A mass democratic society is inevitably one that, in order for politicians to stay in power, they must appeal to very short-term interests, immediate interests. A mass democratic society is inherently incapable of doing what is good for the long term. It's a little bit like expecting children to vote on what they're going to have for dinner every night. They're going to vote for ice cream or candy every time. That's what the Democratic politicians. I mean, we just seen this recently in Scotland. In order to appease the voters in Scotland, politicians made huge, big promises about you're going to have these rights and so forth. Then immediately, of course, in Northern Ireland and Wales, said, "Well, we all want those rights too." I mean, this it's all very short term. It's all about money,
Such people have no real vision of any long-term future. They lurch from crisis to crisis with any idea of where this is all going, except a kind of vague idea we're all going to live in a kind of rainbow nirvana and all holding hands. There's no evidence of that anywhere in the world that they can point to, either in history or in the present. In fact, if the 20th century teaches anything, it's the fragility, the weakness of multicultural, multiracial societies. In our lifetime, we've seen the breakup of the Soviet Union, of Yugoslavia, not even Czechoslovakia held together. I mean, Czechs and Slovaks are virtually, I mean, about as close as two people can be, and they want governments like themselves. They want people like themselves. The United States' position in the world is, it doesn't matter if your leaders are, if you're in Crimea and you're a Russian, you shouldn't care whether your government and your leaders are Russians, Ukrainians, or Nigerians. If we're Democrats and we're all just individuals, what difference does it make? That's the official view of the United States. And this is all madness. And like I said, like the Soviet Union, operating on premises that are not rooted in reality. In fact, the Soviet Union stayed more true to reality in many of its policies than we are here in the United States or in Britain. And this, therefore, I think that, as I said, we must above all try to lay out these what I think is the reality for people, especially younger people, who must and will be leaders in the future, in the wreckage, I hope, of this present system.
What you said about Europe as being made by the genetic makeup of the European people, I actually agree with you, the whites, basically, if you want to be honest.
Yeah.
I agree with that, but don't you think there is something else? Maybe because of the genetic makeup of the whites, but they chose something which was very powerful and which had a lot of importance, in my opinion, in the building up of Europe, and that's Christianity. What role do you give to Christianity in all this?
There's a lot of discussion. In fact, it's very interesting you should raise that. Just, 2 weeks ago, exactly 2 weeks ago, we had a meeting at which Tomislav Sunik spoke, and he raised this very question. It's the first time I've seen it raised because it's a provocative one. It's a very controversial one. How really helpful for us today is Christianity, yes. Is this heritage? Yes. Because Christianity is a universal religion. Sure. It's not a European. I mean, it has been rooted in Europe. Its flowering took place in Europe. It is very identified with Europe. But today, the majority of Christians around the world are not European. Yeah. And so there's an enormous conflict now within the Catholic Church and within Christianity. I mean, the majority of Anglicans around the world are not English. It's called the Church of England, but they're not English.
Yes.
I mean, this is crazy. There's an inherent contradiction there. And a similar kind of confusion takes place with the Catholic Church, with other Christian religions. This is a big problem, and I don't know what the answer is. Some people also, and Sunik raised this question in his talk, that it may be that the Christian emphasis on guilt and original sin may be a very harmful one. Because this idea that we're guilty, we have to atone, we have to always try to watch out for other people may be also another feature of this.
Can I say something? I think that Christianity is a lot misinterpreted, though. Maybe because it's not very well known. I mean, in the West itself, in Europe itself, it's not well known. Lots of people don't know anything about
this
Christianity.
Is a,
and this idea of guilt, sorry, I think that, yes, the anthropology of Christianity is that man is a sinner, yes. But it's true, let's be honest. The left thinks that all men are good, you know, naturally, which is not true. We can't see that men are not naturally good. But the idea in Christianity is that man has all these bad impulses, etc., but can redeem himself, can achieve the heightness of God. Well, that's the idea, but it can be. So it's not really, I mean, guilt and sin is just one aspect of it. The other aspect could be actually very liberating. And maybe Christianity, actually, in my opinion, Christianity has had a lot to do with the uniqueness of the West,
yes,
and
yeah.
Europe.
Yes. Well, I'm just astonished that at the meeting 2 weeks ago, when Sunik made these points, exactly the point you're making was made by people in the audience, and there was a discussion like this. And they essentially said, the people who represent Christianity today are not really representing, they say, true Christianity. Now, if that's true, whether it's true or not true,
In the same way,
these are the people. These are these
they are
the
moderate Muslims, but they don't really represent Islam.
Okay,
right. We'll take three questions all at the same time. Then he'll answer them at the same time. Then we'll have to call it a day. So, white shirt, beige jumper, and blue shirt over there. So you first.
Okay. The collapse you refer to. Do you think that perhaps our leaders are the collapse that was referred to? Do you believe that the that our masters are also prepared for this collapse and have contingency plans? I'm thinking specifically of the FEMA camps and that kind of thing. No.
So that's the first question. And the second question.
I don't want to go back to Buchanan again.
A bit louder, please.
I don't want to go back to Buchanan again, but he did publish that book, you know, Churchill, Hitler and the Unnecessary War, yeah. Challenging that World War II grand narrative is important. But also, you say the English version of him, Peter Hitchens, also declared his intention to make a similar book. Do you think if this can get to the semi-mainstream, you know, challenging that Second World War narrative, you know,
and third question.
Yes, one of the great failures of our movement is a failure to paint an inspiring positive picture of an achievable future. And I'm wondering to what extent Barlow Sandlin does that.
Okay, these are all good questions. First one, no, I don't think the leaders are thinking ahead. They're thinking of the next election, maybe. They're not really anticipating any drastic difference. And also, in history, systems usually do not break down except under some external pressure. The Ottoman Empire, the Romanov Dynasty, the Habsburg Empire all break down under the pressure of the First World War. It's hard to know what will happen. As they say, it's hard to make predictions, especially about the future, but I don't think anybody is really anticipating. There are enormous forces now loose in the world that can spin out of control. And we don't know what shape this will take. I think one of the biggest challenges for the next few years is what is going to be the relationship increasingly between Europe, that include Britain, Germany especially, France, on the one hand, the United States on the other, because increasingly the interests of all other countries are really diverging from that of the United States, especially with regard to the Middle East. The world does not have an interest in war with Iran. The world does not have an interest in the US invasion of Iraq. It doesn't benefit anyone except one country in the Middle East, and its leaders as they see it in the United States. That's one thing. The second point about Buchanan, yes, that's one of the greatest services of Pat Buchanan, is that he is a very, very effective, persuasive writer, a good synthesizer, and his book, Churchill, Hitler, and the Unnecessary War, is extremely important. It adds, again, to a body of literature, including works by Niall Ferguson, A.J.P. Taylor, David Hogan, which all, I think, show that the standard narrative of the Second World War is false. And interestingly enough, for the United States and the Soviet Union, the old Soviet Union, holding on to the official narrative of World War II was crucial to their sort of worldview, their ideology, and so challenging that is indirectly a challenge. It says in